Welcome to the Shanty Sound Podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Byrne, and to celebrate the 10-year anniversary of Shanty Sound, I've started my very own podcast exploring one of my favourite topics, the healing power of music and sound. I'm a lifelong musician, and I've also been working extensively with sound therapy and sound healing for many years now. And I'm guessing that perhaps like me, you're here because you're also interested in all things to do with healing music and sound. Over the last 10 years, both through travelling and the internet, I've met some pretty awesome people, and I'm excited to get to know them even better through these interviews. I'm really interested in people and what draws them to begin sharing music and sound in a healing or therapeutic way, and in learning more about the healing and uplifting effects of immersing in sound and music. So if you do enjoy this podcast, I would love you to hit the subscribe button on whichever app you're listening on, and do feel free to leave a review or a comment. And you can also check out the show notes from this and every episode at shantysound.com.au/podcast. Well, I'm so excited to be here for this episode of the podcast with two incredible women, Sally Skews, a clinical psychologist, and Elizabeth Holbert, who is a music educator and performer. Welcome to you both.
Hi, how are you going?
Hello.
Hi, I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Great, feeling great.
Yeah, excited about coming together to share about this topic.
Yeah. I'm excited to hear what you both have to say. I feel like it's going to be really interesting for our listeners. And yeah, what I've been starting off with all of the people that have jumped on this show is finding out a little about everybody before we get into the sort of content of what you have to share. So I'd love to hear from each of you about your background, maybe where you grew up and where you are now, and anything that you'd like to share in between. And I'd also love to know what it is that's drawn you to the work that you both do. Mm-hmm. So Sally, would you like to start?
Yeah, so I am a clinical psychologist, and I've always been in Adelaide, and a big part of my work is working with children, and I've worked for a number of years with children on the autism spectrum. And you know, even early on, like, there were some really powerful stories of non-verbal children learning to recognize their name within songs and rhythmic songs, and I guess that's really what led me to think, wow, this plays a huge role in communication, but also soothing the nervous system. And in my work, probably for the last 10 years or so, I've worked with children and adults, and what brings these areas of work together is the natural healing aspects of sound and how we use sound in speech, but also can integrate the aspects of soothing and of being together and the attunement through either singing together or mantra and chanting are other key areas too. And about 2 years ago, I started in your choir, Michelle, and being able to feel the collective joy and love for each other, and the healing aspect of, you know, connecting to your own spirit and voice too. And so I've really brought together the therapeutic aspect now to also participating in that and being able to offer healing in some ways, but be healed as well. So yeah, that's pretty much where I'm at now.
Love that, Sally. That's like you're learning all these amazing things, and you're also getting to reap those benefits by processing it yourself. right?
Totally. Yeah.
Incredible. And Elizabeth, tell me about you.
I was born in Sydney and eventually came over here when I was about 4 or 5 and then stayed with my family and grew up here and then mostly in the north and, started loving music at about 8, which is a great age when you can really grab hold of an instrument if you have the opportunity, which I did. And so my first performance was at 8 years old, and I've been performing for 27 years now. my first performance was Mary Had a Little Lamb, I think. I've been teaching for 16 years. So with performing often comes teaching. I love passing things down. When I was studying at the Elder Conservatorium of Music, I studied a Bachelor of Music Performance and Honours in Performance. And horn playing and performing kind of led me to teaching. Passing down my knowledge wasn't really a legacy. It was just automatic almost. And when I see I do see my students kind of light up when they get things right and when they learn new things. It's almost addictive to keep teaching. I love seeing it, and I love spending that time with them, even if it's 30 minutes or 25 minutes a week. That time is just so important for me and more for them. They get that one-on-one time with someone who's only all about them and what they're doing musically and what they're expressing and emotionally or creatively. And I love spending that time with them. I just can't get enough of that. And also as a student myself, I've studied in Quebec, Switzerland, Germany, New Zealand, Netherlands, all across Australia, and I also can't get enough of learning myself. It's sometimes uncomfortable, but it just, the reward is worth more than the uncomfortable feeling of the struggle to get something right. Yeah, and I did play with the Adelaide Symphony Orchestra on a casual basis for 6 years, helping them out when they didn't have enough horns and helping them out when someone was sick or someone had a headache. And that was probably the best job I could have had in playing French horn, and incredible memories and fantastic people. And then I did extra study, and doing extra study in the area of music and brain neurology with Dr. Anita Collins, and absolutely loving it. So I've done a starter course and I've done an educator course about how music affects the brain and music affects language and learning, which is helping me in my everyday job of teaching music and passing that down as well. So that's a really big interest of mine.
I'm sure we're going to hear a bit more about that today. Yeah?
Yeah, definitely.
It really sounds incredible and what you've both got to share. Sally, are you going to start by sort of giving us an overview?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And just to kind of set the stage for how we will share the information, because when Elizabeth and I were coming together, there's just so much to share. And I guess we have tried to introduce some of the theory first in terms of starting developmentally with where we begin as babies and the relationship that we inherently have with sound from when we're born. And we'll then move through the stages of development, and I'll focus on the healing aspects with adults who maybe have missed some of early experiences of soothing, and now are at a point that you may feel like you missed the boat in a sense, but actually, there's a lot of amazing research, and I've experienced clinically too how powerful it can be later in your life. So, Elizabeth's gonna start us off with her knowledge around babies.
Amazing.
Okay. So sound starts towards the end of the third trimester. The last 3 months in utero is where listening actually begins. A baby's auditory perception is perfect at birth. They can recognise their tribe and parents by birth too. There is an important brain triangle comprised of three cortex with main sensory areas: the auditory cortex, the ears, the visual cortex, the eyes, and the motor cortex, the body. When we refer to these components with music neurology and brain research, there are three cortical areas of the brain. Dr. Anita Collins, in her book, The Lullaby Effect, said babies use sound and music to make sense of their world. In a study of one-day-old babies, it was observed that they hear voice as if it were music.
And this, from a psychological perspective, this is so important because at this very young age, we're learning to become attuned to our parent, but the child is also learning to become attuned to the parent as well. And what this leads to is like a visceral experience of reciprocity and like a felt sense in our internal organs when we don't yet have language of the relationship with our primary attachment figure.
Wow. So we actually sort of interpret that as a feeling in the body. Mm-hmm.
Yes, very much. It that felt sense is so, so strong at that point.
Wow.
And so before 12 months, babies start to distinguish speech as noise. So which sounds are speech and not noise, like an oven or a cooling fan? They are hearing vowels most commonly. Consonants are harder, and even harder still are transitions and phonological representation, where they try to find what sounds represent what. So yes is a nose. What means what? For instance, an example might be them repeating a commonly heard swear word through and without realising what the representation is, which... It's pretty funny when it happens. This is where the familiar fireworks term comes into the discussion, which you might have heard. It was used when some white-coated lab researchers behind glass were eagerly looking into the fMRI screens. These screens measure through colour representation, functional magnetic resonance, detecting changes through the blood flow in the brain when children were playing music. This is more interesting now that baby is starting to learn music too. The fMRI machine lit up all three areas of the cortices triangle in the brain and astounded researchers who saw all sorts of colours blinking on their screens. Fireworks, they said. Wow. This is exciting because babies are recognising pitch and repeating back now. So the human voice is recognised by pitch at that kind of age. The auditory cortex now registers sound that creates awareness and alerts us to sound that draws attention and guides vision, incorporating those rhythmic sounds to organise and promote rhythm. The visual cortex acts as a warning system amongst integrating all three motor skills to modify behaviour. And the motor cortex, the third one of the triangle, anchors us in place, incorporating movement information with all of our senses. And practice of music is what strengthens those three brain functions mentioned, allowing us to use these skills in other areas. It should be noted there is a distinct difference between playing and listening, however.
I was just going to ask that.
Yeah, so it's not the same. Playing combines the linguistic mathematical precision of the left hemisphere of the brain with the novel and creative content of the right hemisphere. And when both are active, multiple areas of the brain are lighting up simultaneously, processing different information in intricate, interrelated, and astonishingly fast sequences. The cortices triangle we mentioned is forming a superpower hub in the brain. And it is for these reasons that music has been found to increase the volume and activity in the brain's corpus callosum, so the bridge between the two hemispheres, allowing messages to get across faster, which improves executive function. Things like planning, spatial skills, attention. So say a parent is singing and the baby wants to wriggle away but is totally captivated and pays attention.
Mm-hmm.
Empathy, another one. Say a parent makes noises of discomfort or sadness and baby reacts with touching and hugs and kisses. self-regulation, sitting still in music class, resolving conflict is another executive function skill. I really want to move, but the music has stopped in the musical chairs game. And teamwork. So singing a song about picking up the toys will actually usually work as they sing and play along. So singing to our babies does develop their brains. Babies use what they hear to move. Remembering the cortices triangle and auditory, visual and motor cortices are all working together. Babies collect and collect and collect, then try to build pathways in the brain with what they see and hear to make the body move. These connections are brand new and forming. For example, when baby hears you singing, auditory cortex and the motor cortex connection, and they just want to move it and groove it, you might see baby innocently bouncing in time or out of time gleefully to your catchy tune. I'm sure there's plenty of videos of that. these connections and pathways are now getting stronger and stronger. Again, Dr. Anita Collins said in her book, The Lullaby Effect, the desire to move in time is what makes auditory and motor cortices in the brain talk to each other. And music is the most powerful mechanism to facilitate that talking.
Wow.
It's huge when you consider that. You think about learning to walk and everything like that, and just how interrelated they are. I think that, you know, that's what so much of the music education research that Elizabeth speaks of is has brought, hasn't it? Like an understanding that it's beyond just enjoyment in participating in music.
Yeah, I think people don't realise, but I know we have to burp baby after a feed, but the actual patting is usually done consistently at 120 beats per minute, which is actually double our heartbeat. And if parent gets tired, they usually go back down to half of that, which is 60 beats per minute, which is a nice, really slow heartbeat. So
wow,
that's actually naturally quite phenomenal that someone has noticed that. And then the person that most notices it is baby. So they go, oh, can you please keep patting me at that tempo, that speed? That's really quite nice. And when it stops, they're not impressed. Please keep patting me at that beat. That was quite nice because that's quite natural for them.
Wow. That's so interesting. There was a woman I spoke to, she's a music artist, Katie Underwood, recently, and she talked about her sleep music that she's made, and she said she deliberately made it at 60 beats per minute.
So,
that's interesting. So that's our heart rate.
Yeah, like a really low one, 60 beats is very, very relaxed, and double that, excited about going to the gym, 120 is, you know, really a cool gym tempo.
I'm with you.
Laurel J. Trainer, an auditory development researcher at McMaster Uni in Hamilton, Canada, did a study aimed to measure the effect of weekly parent-infant music classes on musical development, language development, social and brain development. Her control group of babies and parents participated in weekly passive listening classes only. So that's what we're talking about.
Okay.
Playing and only listening.
Yep.
So she had the two groups she was looking at. The age range and time was 6 months to 12 months. The babies were played a Western tonal tune. Then the same tune was played atonally, so mixed up without a central theme or key. Towards the end of the study, the babies exposed to the music classes at 12 months wanted to hear the westernized tune over the atonal tune. The control group with the passive music classes, they didn't care. Also, the music class babies developed non-verbal communication patterns like holding a banana to their ear as a phone and a fork to their mouth for food. The control group, they did not. Laurel J. Trainer, the researcher, said, singing is universal. Singing to infants is also universal. So we sing with intent, like lullabies. So hush, little baby, we sing super soft, super sweet, and something like a playtime song, like Here We Go Round the Merry-Go-Round, is very quick, snappy and happy. And infants react differently. Through repetition, this is trust building also. We talk to infants using musical speech. Dr. Collins says babies that are just starting to develop that understanding often use their parents' emotional responses to interpret sounds. This type of language is known as motherese or parentese, aka baby talk. There are lots of ups and downs, changes in pitch, speed, and rhythm, which are, of course, exaggerated. By exaggerating, we are emphasizing differences in sound and melody, therefore singing, and giving babies the ability to process a complex group of sounds that make up speech. An exaggeration of language using specific rhythms in English or French or syllables, sometimes a famous rhyme or children's song, throwing in a favorite top hit even, is our singing parentese form of communication to babies.
And we've actually got a couple of examples of motherese or parentese that will play now, just so you can really hear the emotional variation that naturally occurs. So this, we often do this without thinking about it, but the power of doing it can't be understated. So we've got a few clips.
So you should be able to hear parents singing that parentese form of up and down pitch, and you should be able to definitely hear baby responding in a similar type of repetitive way.
And there's a second example as well.
This one's a pretty cute little guy. That's just one word, and the baby just is responding with a laugh, but you can hear right at the end of the laugh, the baby goes, squeak, because he can hear, chew. Mm-hmm. He can hear that the end of what parent is saying is really high pitched. So he's trying to sing as well, trying to get that high note, and his high note is much higher than parents.
What we see, not only are the parent and the child attuning to the sound, but this intonation actually really shifts the physiology as well. A researcher, Dr. Stephen Porges, has looked into our nervous system's innate ability to create and maintain feelings of protection, support, and social connectedness. So like you could hear in the short clip, we're socially connected species in a sense. So from birth, we have that need to connect and that need to receive safety cues from our parents through facial expressions, voice, and also parentese or a lullaby. And this really protects us from our nervous system being stuck in risk or threat and scanning our environment for signs of risk. And we see that having the safety cues that music and rhythm and sound can provide actually protect us and buffer us from the damage in a way of stress, because when our system is stuck in stress, we can't regulate our capacity to take in health producing physiological states. So, an example will be that I've experienced firsthand where people will describe that being in meditation, being in a space of meditation, when your nervous system is very stressed, actually it feels unsafe for them, because for their whole life perhaps they've been stuck in the scanning for stress detection. And the term for this is neuroception. So before we can think about whether a situation is unsafe or not, we're constantly looking for signs of danger without conscious thought of this at all. And it was really, you know, evolutionary. It worked very well because it kept us safe. But now with changes to culture and the fast pace that we're expected to be at a lot of the time, it really contributes to that stress. And we can never have the opportunity to reset our nervous system, you know, and to bring in these safety cues. And this is shown to be very, very important. And a lot of the trauma-focused approaches that I use, we adopt the timing of the way we speak for it to be suggestive of a human heartbeat. It conveys a sense of safety to the person because, you know, like Elizabeth shared, it's that feeling of being soothed or missing that experience earlier in life. We're trying to bring in some of these biological components which can communicate comfort, soothing, calmness and safety, and dampen the fight or flight response that we're in so much of the time. And yeah, the research on this nerve system in the body, which is called the vagus nerve, which runs through our whole body, really shows the importance of social connection and engagement, and spontaneous social engagement too. So, you know, laughing with someone or, you know, finding any opportunity to exercise this social engagement system through warmth that you can communicate, by producing melodic voices, and by seeking direct face-to-face interaction in real time through collaborative play, and also dancing and singing. Next time you see someone sing, or even better, a group of people who are resonating with each other, you can see the healing in their faces, in the softening of the face, and the shared joy.
Yeah, and that when they're doing that together at the same time with the same beat and the same syntax and sometimes the same pitch even. I think of this, Louis Butcher Poffley wrote a book and he said, this rhythm is life. He said, from heartbeats heard in the womb to rhythmic patterns of thought, rhythm is life. He said, you know, some tunes just make you want to move. We've almost all experienced it. We thought we might have some fun and see, ask you two questions. Second one's a bit hard, but the first question is pretty the important one. We have a little Sally and Elizabeth playlist, and we just want to know, does this make you want to move? this one. Now, specifically, I mean, Michael Jackson was extremely an incredible musician, and yeah, if he didn't write that to make people move, I don't know what he wrote it for. this one, another great musician. Yeah, six of me, yeah. I mean, you have to move in that one. There's actual steps to that one. I mean, sometimes you just have to move, and like a lot of successful musicians have written music particularly to get people to move.
And if you're not aware of these songs, we'll acknowledge the amazing artists in the notes with the podcast so you can have a listen.
Yeah.
Great.
And to further from that, Daniel Levitin's book, This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession, he goes on to talk about athletes and people that, for us, train the treadmill and how they too have used the groove and the beat. So they play music more often than not that is slightly faster than their natural running gait or speed. So neurons begin firing. In a musician's brain, the tempo, as I said earlier, like speeds up, and so do we. So instead of a maestro conducting, you use the music as a click track. This effect is now incredibly being used to treat the shuffling gait of Parkinson's patients, as the motor and auditory cortices within that triangle, again, are so heavily intertwined. So with the Parkinson's patients, they put on a slower click track for headphones for these patients, and the patients try walking to the click track step by step, assisted by rails each side through down a corridor. And would you believe it, they can keep walking pace by pace, they can keep walking. You take away the click track and they're fumbling and they can't. The Parkinson's shakes just gets to them and they are. So that down that rabbit hole is extremely positive research is coming out of there with the click track without music, and music's probably going to be a part of that research that comes out of that. Nina Kraus found through a pair of longitudinal studies in Chicago and Los Angeles that children who struggle to produce or hear rhythms also have difficulty with language processing and reading. She's also discovered that playing an instrument or singing for 2 years can fundamentally and permanently improve a child's cognitive abilities. Nowadays, the research shows, music neurologists agree, that for the most benefit to assist language development, that learning with a qualified pedagogue for 10 minutes daily involving singing movement, an instrument, and being able to read symbols or notes before the age of 5 years for at least 2 years, preferably five years learning, are results in direct causation research results that music education can enhance language skills and gives learners better executive function. This is such a profound effect and compelling argument for music education, I think. So what is executive function and what exactly are the benefits of early childhood music education? It is known that the anatomic structure of the brain changes through intensive practice of a musical instrument. Musicians are seen to have a larger corpus callosum, the bridge between the two hemispheres. Well, executive function or grown-up skills are all day-to-day type tasks and are proven to be higher functioning in babies and children who are musically trained. We talked about them just before, but some examples are improved attention, understanding when it's your turn to speak, also improved memory skills, having a working memory, then deleting the negatives at the end of the day, teamwork. This is anything from babies clapping together with parent to breathing together in a phrase, sharing and handing over melodies in a round, to standing up together to receive applause at their very first concert. Spatial skills, babies in the group dance class, knowing their space, and multitasking. So in my case, I sometimes work with a band program of eight-year-olds. So in a band program environment, you could see unpacking, setting up, listening, holding instruments, blowing, reading notation, following along, surpassing mistakes, getting to the end of the piece together, reflecting and performing. That's a lot of multitasking, I think, for little eight-year-olds. Higher executive function and music learning helps students become better general learners because they are comfortable with being uncomfortable. And this is where learning begins and continues. We should also be checking in with them here, as they can be feeling a lot, I think. Part of executive function is also social skills and health. So a student's ability to play music and listen to how it feels, break it down, work on rhythm, pitch and melody, thinking, do I recognise this? Working on it. Yes, I do recognise this. And the healthiest part of this is the physical release of dopamine into the body and practising and recreating that release. It's a chemical reaction that is proven causational research, yeah. So
So it makes us feel good.
Yeah.
And it has all those other amazing effects with the executive function.
Yeah, being able to, I mean, I've got music students that have great time management skills, great multitasking abilities. I've got music students in year 10, for French horn students that are doing vet courses in year 10 outside of their normal school hours, plus tennis, plus basketball, plus everything else that every other year 10 does. But they're also going to go and do a business management course in down at the TAFE, just to up their ante a little bit.
Wow.
I think that's and they're a music student and have been since year 8. Yeah, and this is their second instrument they're learning from me. They're learning two instruments. So
wow.
Yeah.
Gosh. Based on what both of you have just shared, I'm just thinking about two things. One is that in our Western culture, music isn't always accepted as a day-to-day norm. There are people in families who say, I'm not musical, and I think that there might be parents out there that don't sing to their children,
yes.
don't use music or singing, or, you know, people shy away from it. Whereas I think in other cultures, you know, babies and children are naturally drawn into singing, and it's part of daily life.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, what are the effects on our culture with children who are missing this, as babies or children?
Yes, the language development is much slower.
Mm. And we're in to be honest, we're in a mental health pandemic.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Where we learn to attach through music. And a perfect example is, in other cultures, the baby stays so close to their attachment figure for a number of years. They stay so close to the heart to get that sense of the heartbeat.
Yes.
And our culture, there are a couple of things that I see in my work, that really show this disconnection. And it's the disconnection to the self, because we learn intention through language, which we've learned today is we experience through music. So your blueprint of a relationship isn't as secure because you don't have a language with another person. And unfortunately, the pace of Western society, it pushes development too far. So what that leads to is children unable to self-regulate because they haven't been able to co-regulate with the attachment figure, or the, they say it takes like a village to raise a child, and it really doesn't. That phrase, often the whole village is singing to the child. And even research has come out that, in other cultures, like the transition to adolescence, which is such a difficult transition because the brain is changing so much, in other cultures there are initiations around that time of adolescence that are led by elders who guide the whole process. And what we see in adolescence in Western culture is they're moving away from the family and that sense of belonging too soon into the peer circle, because they're the environments that they spend most of the time in, with the heavy scheduling and, the long hours at school. And what that leads to, that disconnect leads to trying to find that sense of social belonging in a totally new social group to them. And actually, with my interest in mental health, it alarmed me to learn that 75% of all mental health conditions start in adolescence, but it's like, by bringing this information in, and almost, a lot of my work is moving towards the childhood origin and meeting the need so that the individual can complete that developmental step that they missed, unfortunately, which I think it's a product of the culture in many sense. Like the, you know, even if you think of sleeping together in a family bed, like that doesn't work if a parent has to work the next day and they need to sleep. So, you know, all of these natural processes that occur where we experience stress and are soothed and then experience a little bit more and then are soothed, that becomes disrupted. And yeah, you know, really you can just have that feeling of your nervous system never being at rest and just constantly you know, feeling tense or anxious. But yeah, the good thing is that there are ways that we can work with this now through sound.
Yeah, and babies between 6 and 12 months are already developing non-verbal communication skills through learning music, and without that they can't tell from a parent or an adult what an adult or a parent's non-verbal communication skills mean, which I think is can be of extreme importance in education. And yeah, and if they learn that through singing and we don't do that, then a non-verbal cue from a parent, if it's missed, can be extremely detrimental. Like, yeah, if a side glance to say no is missed, that can be very bad for a 12-month or a 6-month baby. Yeah. And if it could have been fixed by just singing a lullaby and by talking by variation of pitch and rhythm, it could be a great loss to a child. Yeah.
Mm. Wow, this is all so interesting. Sally, I'd love to hear more about how you're working with people and how you incorporate music and sound into your work.
Yeah, one of the early things I want to say, because like I mentioned before, some people, you know, if their nervous system has been in such a high level of stress for so long, moving to a calm state, because it's different and we, you know, we're always scanning for risk, it feels unsafe and quite distressing, you know. So what we start by doing is, it's called pendulation in a sense. So you we approach the feeling of calming down very slowly and gently for a very short period of time, and then because that will feel unsafe if they've not been in that state before, a defense follows in a sense. So they might feel themselves you know, they're thinking, kicking in or something like that. So, you know, a lot of my work, which is focusing on developmental trauma, really focuses on doing it very slowly, that pendulation. So touching into the calmness for a brief period and then allowing the person to naturally move back towards the defense that they've always had, and then coming back to the calmness a little bit. And it's where this approach, you know, like a swing pendulum almost, is so helpful, because what I find is a lot of people will come to me and they'll say, oh my God, I tried to do breathing with this person and it was awful. I started panicking. And what I learned, and is backed up by the research, it's that touching your toe in and then being able to come back out, that's the key. So that's one of the things. But another way of introducing sound and music is by allowing the person to express themselves in this way. So when we are in intense trauma, we become speechless. You know, you've had that feeling where you witness or experience something so significant that you can't actually put your thought and feeling into words, and you end up feeling quite misunderstood because, you know, others may try and speak for you, but it just doesn't, it doesn't resonate with that experience. So, you know, what we try and do is by bringing in these other aspects, whether it's sharing music that reflects the feeling or producing music that reflects that feeling, to as a means of self-expression. And also, I really now am a strong advocate too about collective movement and music. So, you know, because this creates a larger context for our lives and a meaning beyond our individual fate. You know, in our choir, Michelle, it's like, yes, people come to sing, but that is actually, I'd say, even a smaller component than the belonging and the community of, yeah, of singing together. And this collective power has been something that is demonstrated through religious ritual, the liturgy and gestures of Catholic Mass, to meditation and Buddhist practices and ceremonies. And we've actually got an example to show. Just, we're just going to listen to it for a minute or so, just to hear the rhythm, the pitch and the melody and the togetherness as well that can come as a result of that. So this is chanting, Tibetan monks chanting with very ancient horns that are tuned in different tones as well.
Oh, I wanted to listen to that for the rest of the day.
Yeah, we'll share the link, but you can hear that collective, you know.
Just wouldn't be the same if there was one of them.
Oh, the coming together.
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
And this, I wanted to touch on different aspects of the coming together through music as well. This was seen through the civil rights movement in the United States, where through song we can really be bound together to become advocates for ourselves and others, and to instill a sense of hope and courage as well as a collective, you know, versus an individual. It's like with performing, you know, would I be able to perform as an individual singer? No. But in the choir, you have the courage that comes. So, and I really think that anybody can be part of that as well. Everybody can sing. You know, we hear that it's so natural. And sound and singing in rhythm has been used in military drill, marching in step. That leads to co-regulation between the group of people. And we actually just wanted to play a small clip of this for the women's liberation movement march in 1971, just to give you a snippet of what this sounds like.
Very common, very.
Yeah. And I wanted to share one thing that, yeah, I just, you know, inputting, in thinking through what we present, I found it so amazing that Estonia were actually under Soviet Union, and it was a very small country, and they didn't really have, anyone backing them to become independent. And they actually started a singing revolution in their in the country, where
wow.
this freed them from the Soviet Union. They're coming together in sound. And yeah, I found that just amazing.
And they've recently found that not in our COVID pandemic times, but when the masses were at music festivals and the music pumped so loudly and the people were so close and they were moving together to the beat en masse, that their heartbeats, their body temperatures, and even how much they were sweating had been known to align in this really strong connection at those huge kind of huge festivals.
Wow.
And on that, we were thinking, like, if you've, and it's familiar, the what was the concert, the live?
Oh, Live Aid. Yeah, so Live Aid, there was only 72,000 people there in Wembley, 72,000 people, but they raised $17.2 million by sound. So, people that had switched on their radios or their wireless and things like that. There's only 72,000 people there, which is not actually a record these days of how many people go to a concert. We fit more than that in the oval here, but the amount of money through song for that cause was heard, I don't think is heard of these days, like the charity through music was remarkable.
Yeah, and we wanted to touch on the COVID pandemic a little bit and what this means.
That'd be interesting. And
I was speaking about how so much healing comes through social engagement and connection. But we're really in a unique time at the moment where, with COVID, social interaction is actually a threat. And this is very, I think that it leads to unsettled nervous systems, because our natural tendency as mammals, you know, to move towards each other is being interrupted with the threat threat detection that comes through with COVID. And I do wonder what effects we'll see for many years to come on this period of time in development for children as well, because of the, you know, music education going to online settings. But the positive aspect that I did hear about and have experienced myself is that, you know how, like, in the past when we would be on our laptop or iPad, sometimes people would be multitasking when we're communicating, you know, like you'd be typing or whatever it was. But actually what we're seeing now is that like the laptop or the Zoom meeting is used as a way to communicate, we're actually paring back the multitasking, and we're using it as a way to bring in that social engagement. But also we wanted to play a clip of how even at home music can be used as a source of self-expression in COVID times as well. And I think that that's the key thing, that we continue expressing ourselves, and we'll play this to show this.
Our face, which is not fair. COVID-19. almost everything. And
extremely expressive.
Yeah. That skill development in the sense of using this time to reconnect, because a lot of people are learning to play the ukulele and other instruments while they have this time.
It's such a form of release. I think the girl looks about eight or something, so for her to use that as a form of release, I don't think she'd say all those words to her parents, but she is happy to learn one chord on the ukulele and just belt them all out.
Mm-hmm. Great way to express.
This is our final thought, and we thought, gee, we can't speak about sound and healing without touching on Dr. Masaru Emoto's work.
Yeah, so he's a Japanese doctor of alternative medicine, a researcher and independent thinker from Yokohama Municipal University. In his book, The Secret Life of Water, where he visually captures the structure of water at the moment of freezing, especially when exposed to music, thoughts, and prayer, he said, water is part of the rhythm of life. There's an excerpt from his book that, funnily enough, got covered in water on the way here. My drink bottle was open. That's very fitting. He says, music as a healing force. Alan Rupik is an American pianist who has based his musical career on the principle that music has the ability to heal. His piano music has no rival in clarity. Many who listen to it say that they feel like their bodies become transparent. Alan had an experience when he was a young boy which convinced him that music had the power to heal, and since that time he had based his career on writing music for healing. He started playing the organ at age 3 as a child prodigy, and from age 9, he focused on the piano and on writing and performing. But in his teen years, his life took a sudden change. He injured the ulnar nerve in his right arm during physical education class at school, making it painful and nearly impossible to move his fingers. For several months, he was unable to play the piano. The muscles in his fingers began to weaken. It seemed as if the road to his future had suddenly become insurmountable, and the realization that he would likely lose the music which he loved so much sent him into a deep depression. He tried thinking about other futures, but he always found himself sitting in front of the piano. And then one day, perhaps in utter desperation, he put his hands on the keyboard and let whatever was in his heart come out. Alan says that what he felt at that moment was something like happiness in his fingers. He could feel the energy flowing through his hands and the resonance between the sound of the piano and the movement of his fingers. Alan's hands began to recover almost immediately, and it wasn't long before he was able to play as good as before or even better. Dr. Emoto says, I first met Alan in 1995 through an introduction by the scientist who had invented the magnetic resonance and analyzer, MRA. A Hato measuring instrument that is capable of measuring minute vibrations. With the cooperation of this scientist, we asked Alan to compose music that would express the healing powers of Hato. We wanted to have healing music that would be capable of boosting the body's immune system. When the score was complete and recorded, we exposed water to it. And, as might have been expected, crystals formed from the water were exceedingly beautiful and delicate, typical of healing characteristics. When we showed photographs of the crystals to Alan, he said that he was surprised to see that all the crystals formed were identical to the images he had in his mind when he was composing the music. Alan is one of many artists who is highly aware that music is a form of healing. But we also know that the classical music from the past, famous jazz pieces, and folk music from the corners of the world also have the ability to heal in their own individual ways. Dr. Emoto exposed water to classical music from various composers and then took photographs of the resulting crystals. Then he took Hato measurements of the photographs with the MRA. The results revealed the Hato emotional and physical affected by the music. He shares some of the results of that in his other book, The True Power of Water.
And we'll provide the reference to that, so if you'd like to read more about that.
This book is called The Secret Life of Water.
By Dr. Masaru Emoto. Mm. We've got one of his books, and it's a beautiful book I bought James, and it's a hardcover, and it has pictures of those beautiful water crystals. Each one has been exposed to a different classical piece, and it's just so beautiful. And it's got the CDs in it. I bought it a long time ago when CDs were a thing, and you can play the CDs and you can listen to the music and look at the beautiful pictures of the water crystals. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Elizabeth.
Yeah.
I'd love to just hear a little bit more about your work with Bigger Better Brains, because I know that you're really passionate about it.
The amount of research that has been done is a lot, and the amount of research that's starting to come up is huge.
Is this all research around playing a musical instrument and the effect on the brain, or what is it specifically?
Particularly playing rather than listening, because that's a passive type thing to do. So playing the instrument, because both sides start lighting up. As I said, for the fMRI machine, you can see both sides lighting up, and which crosses over for the corpus callosum. No one can see my hands, but it crosses over the corpus callosum, and the corpus callosum then gets bigger. It's actually, you know, a great introduction to someone that's not a musician. You know, my corpus callosum is bigger than yours. You know, I am a musician, but the research is finding more and more that before the age of five, if you are playing an instrument from a teacher that knows what they're doing, not just anyone that can just try and find their way around, that the language skills develop much, much quicker. Not so much the mathematical side of things, but definitely the language skills do. And with babies speaking quicker, like finding phonemes quicker, finding vowels quicker. Yeah, there's a lot of research.
Do you mean if a baby is playing an instrument?
Singing. So that's where the singing side of things, like the parentese things, come into it. The processing of auditory information is much quicker if you're singing along. I've definitely been in a household where we were talking before, where that singing isn't it's just not common. It's like, well, I didn't study at school. Yeah. I don't, you know, what's your favorite band? Or I don't really have one. And for me, it's extremely unusual when people say that, but it does happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then I tend to get those students in with me one-on-one, and I say, haven't you ever heard of Queen? You know, and no, they've never. And you think, gosh, this sounds really strange, but it is true. And or you think, you know, have you ever heard of The Entertainer, and you play them a bit and no, they've never heard of it. Or Frère Jacques, they've never heard of it. And then the language skills and the nonverbal communication is much lower than someone that has been brought up with those little things. And so I can see it in an 8-year-old straight away. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I can also see in babies within my family that have been read to, sung to from birth, the rapid development of speech. Yeah, so it's music directly correlates with the development of speech and language, and they want to know why. So the research is based around they want to know why, they want to know how long, they want to know what, and it is really with an instrument, it's with singing, movement, an instrument, and a person that knows what they're doing. And it is for just 10 minutes at a time before the age of five. The golden number is 4 or 5 years before the age of five, but wow. 2 years.
Before. So the whole first 5 years of their life, ideally.
Yeah, mm-hmm. but two years before the age of five as well is enough to make their speech skills and language skills just skyrocket. So,
and that aligns actually, from a psychological perspective, our internal working model and which is really our expectation or beliefs in relationships are set by 7 years of age. So yeah. that critical period of early childhood and, you know, early school years can really set us up for resilience in life.
Yeah, and the setup, I mean, they're looking at babies, but the setup, the first thing I said, the setup is 3 months, the last 3 months of pregnancy, the third trimester, baby can hear singing, baby can hear what's going on.
Yeah.
And he's already listening before they're welcomed into the world. Like, they can already hear what's going on. That's my interest. And then what, like, that's an even more interesting research topic, because you can get even more of a head start on the language development in that area. So the research, there's a lot of research popping up everywhere to be had, to be done, and it's starting to really come flower. It's starting to really, come into fruition, I think.
Wow. So just a little message to all mums and dads and people that are caring for youngsters, that it's important to sing to them and don't be afraid. Don't let your own hang-ups about singing get in the way.
Well, in fact, the hang-ups people usually have are, oh, I can't sing in tune, so why should I sing to my child? Actually, a baby can't tell if you're singing in tune or not. It can't define whether you're singing in tune. So if you sing out of tune to your baby, they will still very much appreciate it. They can't tell. So whatever you do, if you're going up and down in rhythm and in pitch and changing rhythm, it'll still help their language development, even if you think you're out of tune. Yeah, that's
amazing. Yeah, I think that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Better than silence.
Oh, yeah, sorry, absolutely. So we'll wrap up now, and I want to thank you both so much for coming on today's episode. And
thank you for having us.
Thanks. Bye for now.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Shanti Sound podcast. You can access all of the show notes at shantisound.com.au/podcast. I would love you to subscribe, like, comment, or leave a review wherever you're listening. And connect with me on Instagram at shanti_sound and Facebook at Shanti Sound Australia. The music and sounds featured in the intro and outro are excerpts from the Shanti Sound Soundbath CD, recorded and produced by Michelle and James Byrne. You can download this and other music by Michelle and James Byrne at shantisound.com.au/music. Remember, sound brings healing and presence. The truest and sweetest sound comes from within. So hum, sing and create sound whenever you can. Thanks for listening. I look forward to sharing with you again soon.